You're going to have to pray. This was one of the earlier statements made to us in our training to serve as chaplains in a hospital, us group of future ministers to be. For my Christian colleagues, of course, this was mostly a concern about how much practice they had with spontaneous prayer, praying in the moment with patients who are struggling with significant illness. And for some Unitarian Universalist ministers to be who had a regular prayer practice and were used to praying, again, similar difficulty. But for me, the son of a secular humanist, atheist, Unitarian Universalist father, this was a challenge. Because even though I had shifted my own personal beliefs significantly at that point towards my own form of theism, I had never developed a prayer practice. Now, the good folks at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston were prepared for me, fortunately, because in our diverse country and their diverse city, they served more than just Christian patients. So the next sentence came. You're going to have to pray, and you're going to need to pay attention to the patient's religious background, as well as the beliefs that they have shared in your conversation. Everyone who wants a prayer will want a prayer said in a way that matches their belief, and each person, even within Christianity, is different. Praying isn't about what you want and what you believe, it's about what the patient needs. And so pray I did. After a little trial and error, I prayed my way into a form of prayer that worked for me and attempted to meet my patients where they were. I generally couldn't bring myself to refer to God as my Lord or Savior, and that was okay, because I found my way to praying for healing, to praying with gratitude for the good things that patients had shared about their lives, to praying for patients to be reminded of their own inherent worth and dignity, to praying that patients remember that they are both loved and worthy of love. We also had to shadow each other a few times at different points during that summer, and so I got to observe my Christian colleagues, and yes, we prayed very differently. It didn't matter, though, because even though prayer wasn't and still isn't a spiritual practice that speaks to me personally, those conversations I had as a hospital chaplain and the prayers I offered were not about me. They were about the patients. They didn't frame it this way at the time, but looking back, what the hospital asked us chaplains to do was to practice a form of empathy. Shame researcher Brené Brown defines empathy as feeling with another person, compared with sympathy, which is feeling for another person. Sympathy in this definition is much more disconnected. I'm over here, and you're over there having those feelings, and I'm so sorry for you over there, but I'm here separate from you. Sympathy is meant to help the person on the receiving end feel better, but it often does not. Empathy, on the other hand, is a feeling with. And we don't need to have had the same experience as the person sharing a difficulty to connect with the feeling they're having. Empathy is about connecting with the feeling, not the experience. Now, empathy, of course, can happen in many different ways. It probably most often happens through a serious response, someone being there present with you, but it can also happen through humor sometimes. I'll never forget the day I was working in business and had just been totally shut down by the sales representatives at a big interdepartmental meeting. And I was all down and dejected, and one of our business analysts came up to me afterwards and said, he saw how I was feeling, and he said, "That wasn't cool. Next time I'll tell you what, I'll steal all their cell phones and return them to them in a bowl of Jell-O. How about that?" Now, of course, he didn't actually mean he was going to do that. There would have been hell to pay if that had actually happened. But his joke communicated to me perfectly that he not only knew the feeling that I was having, but also that he was there in it with me. He was feeling with me. This is what all hospital chaplains are asked to do, not to offer supportive words or prayers that are meaningful to themselves, but to offer supportive words and prayers that are meaningful to the patients. To put themselves in their patient's shoes and offer the kind of support and care that the patient wants and needs, and help them know that you understand the feelings they're having, even if you're not sick in the same way they are. In other words, to offer empathetic support. Now, we have a tendency in our culture sometimes to think of empathy as an inherent characteristic that some people are just born with and others maybe a little less so. And before learning about Brené Brown's work, I rarely, if ever, heard anyone talking about empathy as a skill that you could practice. You would think having with that going to seminary, right, that we talk about empathy a whole bunch. And I took quite a few pastoral care classes, but those tended to be more focused on theory rather than this kind of concrete practice. And as it turns out, empathy is in fact a skill we can practice, a muscle we can build if we want to work on it. Working hard to listen with an open heart and staying out of judgment is one way to practice empathy-building skills. Trying to understand the emotion the other person is experiencing is another. One way to try that might be to ask yourself, how can I touch within myself something that feels like maybe what the other person is feeling? You can also check in and clarify what you're hearing, and you can ask questions. Asking questions is always a really good thing. There are also, unfortunately, things we do that sometimes get in the way of an empathetic practice, though. As we've talked about, confusing sympathy or feeling for someone and empathy, feeling with someone, is an easy way to head in the wrong direction. Another barrier we sometimes create is when we offer a form of pain one-upmanship. You think, you've got it bad, well, let me tell you about my friend who... fill in the blank. That kind of response is often intended to help, I think, to try and show someone they don't need to feel as bad as they do, maybe, but it doesn't really work. Another barrier to feeling with someone can be our own inability to connect with the feeling ourselves. If someone is feeling sadness, rage, disappointment, grief, or fear, to feel with them, you have to be able to tap into your own sadness, rage, disappointment, grief, or fear within. Now, we all have different levels of connection with our feelings, and many women struggle with this too. But this can be a particular problem for men in our culture, who are often trained not to connect with or even have our feelings. Our culture generally tells men that they need to be tough and strong not to cry, for example, which leads many men not to be in touch with their feelings. And if you're not in touch with your own feelings, it's pretty hard to feel them with someone else, even if you want to do that. Another challenge, and there's many, and this will be the final one for now, but another challenge with empathy can come if we're not kind or gentle with our own selves. If I judge myself harshly, I'm pretty likely to judge others harshly too. And it's hard to feel with someone when you're judging them. The live stream seems to be having a hard time this morning. So, all this is by way of saying empathy is definitely a skill that we can work to practice and grow in ourselves if we want. And for many of us, it can be a challenge, and I include myself in that group for two reasons. My training and experience has helped me learn many useful things to say, of course. And based on the feedback I've received from many of you, it seems like most of our pastoral conversations the past few years have been meaningful and helpful. Until a couple of months ago, though, I never knew about actually trying to feel with as an intentional practice. And so until recently, I have not consciously brought that intention to my conversations. Which is not to say that, of course, I didn't do some of it instinctively, but I wasn't aware that I could do it on purpose either. The bigger challenge for me, though, until the past few months, has been that practice of feeling with. Because often when I tried to tap into my own feelings, it felt like my own anxiety or fear was too overwhelming. Not that I was incapable of empathizing, of course, but going to that place of my own feelings was hard and scary, and so I tended to stay back and disconnected, which of course meant I struggled to feel with. Now, I'm incredibly grateful for the many people who have helped me on my own journey of growth and healing. And 3 years of therapy and 12 years of spiritual practice and spiritual direction later, I finally feel like just in the past few months that I'm getting to the place of truly being able to be present to my own feeling, my own difficult feelings, which enables me to be much more present to feel with other people. So if you've ever talked with me and felt like the feeling with has been missing, please accept my apologies. Please know I've been doing my best for many years now to do my own work. For myself, of course, so that I can be with my own feelings, and so that I can be a better minister to you. While my own learning curve is hopefully a helpful example, we're not discussing empathy this morning so that I could deliver an apology. We're discussing empathy because on a basic day-to-day level, empathy matters in our relationships with others. We need empathy from each other. There's almost certainly some of us sitting in this room right now who are struggling, who could use some empathetic support. When we're feeling down or alone or sad or fearful or frustrated or any other number of feelings, receiving empathy from another person can lift our spirits and help us know that we are not alone. I imagine most of us present have at some point had an experience of receiving empathy that has been meaningful to you. Whether there was someone listening to you or offering kindness or humor or thoughtfulness, and having that experience lift your spirits during a time of difficulty. Especially in these difficult political times, empathy is a gift we can offer each other to help make life feel less hard. Surprisingly, though, empathy might also be one of the most powerful potential solutions to the polarized and hate-filled political climate that our country is experiencing. Ruby Bridges was a six-year-old African-American girl who happened to be front and center helping lead the way for the desegregation of public schools in the state of Louisiana in 1960. To help support her in the face of threats, taunts, and harassment from white people, she was offered counseling sessions with child psychologist Robert Coles. When asked how she felt about the people who were trying to kill her, she said, "I feel sorry for them." Coles clarified, "You feel sorry for them?" Her response, "Well, don't you think they need feeling sorry for?" Coles later wrote, "I sat there stunned. I was applying standard psychology, trying to help her realize that maybe she was angry at these people, or bitter or anxious, and she was telling me that she prayed for them. I was struck dumb and I was silent because I had to reflect upon this child's wisdom." It takes a strong moral fortitude and a strong sense of self and knowledge of your own self-worth to be able to look hatred and violence from an individual or a group of individuals in the eye and say, "I feel sorry for you." This young girl, only 6 years old, had a personal and moral fortitude that many adults haven't yet managed to claim. She was able to think about what it must be like to have that much hatred inside of you, that you'd be willing to hurt a little girl. And she felt sorry for them. Talk about amazing wisdom. I found Ruby Bridges' story in a book titled Cultivating Empathy by Unitarian Universalist minister Reverend Nate Walker, in which he proposes that to bring about justice in the world, that we must cultivate and practice our moral imagination. He uses the definition of moral imagination he found in the University of Kansas Medical Ethics curriculum, which states, "Moral imagination is the ability to anticipate or project oneself into the middle of a moral dilemma and understand all points of view." Sound familiar? Walker believes transforming the world can only come about through the cultivation of empathy, by putting ourselves in another's shoes and trying to see the world from their perspective. See, empathy as a tool for justice isn't just talk, it isn't just an abstract hope or a nice idea. As we saw in our video reading earlier, there has actually been a study done where researchers attempted to use empathy, both their empathy for the person they are speaking to as well as the person's own empathy for others, to shift someone's perspective on legal protections for transgender people. Quoting a Vox.com article by German Lopez, "A research project authored by David Brookman at Stanford University and Joshua Kalla at the University of California, Berkeley, looked at how simple conversations can help combat anti-transgender issues. Attitudes. In the research, people canvassed the homes of more than 500 voters in South Florida. The canvassers, who could be trans or not, asked the voters to simply put themselves in the shoes of trans people to understand their problems through a 10-minute non-confrontational conversation. The hope was that the brief discussion could lead people to reevaluate their biases. And it worked. The trial found that voters' anti-trans attitudes declined, but that they remained lower 3 months later, showing an enduring result. And those voters' support for laws that protect trans people from discrimination increased, even when they were presented with counterarguments to said laws." Lopez and many others have observed that the single biggest correlation with support for President Trump is not economic anxiety or gender or any other factor, but primarily racial resentment. Research indicates that it's racial resentment that drives the economic anxiety and not the other way around. This is why Trump continues to get away with making blatantly racist statements, and his base, his support, they resonate and they feel the racial resentment. So if we're going to tackle the glaring problems we see in the news on a day-to-day basis and find a way to come back together as a country and move forward at some point without racism, if that's not too much to hope for, though, you know, it may never go away, but the way forward is if we can find a way to heal some of this racial resentment. And Brookman and Kala's study offers us one way to try and help change people's minds: empathetic conversation. Because arguing with people, for the most part, doesn't tend to work, right? It usually just makes them dig in harder. Throwing statistics at people and talking about systems of oppression, that sadly also does not often change minds. But talking to people and empathizing with them, that can and sometimes does work. One of the major changes in Brookman and Kala's study was in how the canvassers talked to people whose doorbells they rang. Typically, canvassers have a pitch they offer to people filled with quotes, facts, and figures. But in this study, the goal of the canvassers was to have the person they were talking to do more of the talking. And it worked. Can you imagine, though, how hard it must have been for that canvasser we observed in the video? I'm sure many, if not most, trans folks or trans allies would have a hard time not getting upset hearing some of those transphobic comments. And that's what we often do on a range of issues, right? On Facebook or in person. How dare you? Or maybe if we're trying to be persuasive, we quote statistics about gun violence or the incarceration levels of people of color. And typically when we respond with anger or even when we respond with facts, the other person often becomes defensive and nothing changes. Thanks to the training he and other canvassers received, though, the gentleman asking questions was able to respond empathetically, resulting in a transformative conversation. As Kala noted, whether you're trans or not trans, gay or not gay, you're still able to develop empathy with a voter and help them connect the prejudice they felt in their lives with the prejudice transgender people face. So friends, as we go about our days, as we go about our lives, for ourselves, for each other, and for the healing our country so desperately needs, may we try to channel our inner Ruby Bridges. May we bring intention to our practice of empathy. May we be kind and empathetic to ourselves. May we bring kindness and empathy to those we care about. And may we bring kindness and empathy to those with whom we disagree. Empathy alone may not transform the world, but it can be a powerful tool to help us move in that direction. Life is hard enough on its own. There will always be people in our communities who can use an empathetic ear. And in our country right now, those who are struggling with racial resentment and fear and pain of all kinds that prompts them to exhibit racist, sexist, homophobic, and other hate-filled behaviors, they need our empathetic support too. Now that may feel like a hard thing to ask, but if 6-year-old Ruby Bridges can do it in the face of death threats, I have faith that we can do it too. The time for passively waiting for empathy to happen by those who are naturally good at it has ended. Life, love, justice, they are all calling us to intentionally create, practice, and live empathy into action, to live empathy into being. May you create, practice, and live empathy into action and into being.